This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. I recently watched a new movie that transported me away from the pandemic and political divisions of today, yet seemed relevant to both. It's set in Texas in 1870, 5 years after the Civil War has ended, when many Texans are bitter about defeat and reluctant to rejoin the Union, which would require agreeing to the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which includes the abolition of slavery. One of the first images we see in the film is of a black man hanging from a tree. White settlers are fighting Native Americans. Everyone is hurting. The film is a Western called News of the World. It stars Tom Hanks. My guest is the director, Paul Greengrass, who previously directed Hanks in the film Captain Phillips. In News of the World, Hanks plays a former Confederate captain, Jefferson Kyle Kidd, who fought in the Texas infantry during the Civil War and surrendered in 1865. The film is set 5 years later, when Kidd is a lonely man with unspoken regrets, eking out a living, traveling from one small, poor Texas town and muddy settlement to another, reading aloud the news from newspapers around the country as a form of information and entertainment to gatherings of people, charging 10 cents a person.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's good to be back with you all here in Wichita Falls. My name is Captain Jefferson Kyle Kidd, and I'm here tonight to bring you all the news from across this great world of ours. Now, I know how life is in these parts, working a trade, sun up to sundown, no time for reading newspapers, am I correct? Let me do that work for you. And maybe, just for tonight, we can escape our troubles and hear the great changes that are happening out there. Starting local then, our own Houston Telegraph, from the 1st of February, this news. The meningitis epidemic continues to spread without prejudice across the Panhandle and North Texas region. So far, it has claimed 97 souls in just a 2 month period. Federal News, our own Dallas Herald.
The director of News of the World, Paul Greengrass, started his career as a journalist and documentary filmmaker. He went on to make films based on real events. Captain Phillips was based on the American cargo ship hijacked by Somali pirates in 2009. 22 July was about the 2011 Norwegian terrorist attack on teenagers at a political summer camp. And United 93 was about the airplane passengers who fought back against the hijackers on 9/11 and died crashing near Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Greengrass has also directed three of the blockbuster Jason Bourne movies. News of the World is in theaters and is available on premium video on demand. Our interview was recorded January 12th. Paul Greengrass, welcome to Fresh Air, and thank you for making this new movie.
Oh, my pleasure. Good to be here.
So although this movie is set in 1870, it's feeling so current to me. Like I said, you know, America still hasn't reckoned with the ongoing racism and racial injustice resulting from slavery, and we haven't fully recovered from the divisions of the Civil War. I mean, one of the images of the insurrection is a man inside the Capitol building holding a very large Confederate flag on a long pole. And of course, one of the first things we see in your film is a black man hanging from a tree with a sign attached to him reading, "Texas says no, this is white man's country." Did the movie feel current to you when you were making it?
It did. I felt when I read the novel that it's based on, Paulette Giles' wonderful novel, News of the World, that there was something about Texas in 1870 in the shadow of the Civil War. America bitterly divided, uncertain where she wants to go, desperately searching for healing but not being able to find it. And this character of the lonely newsreader, the character who'd lost everything in the Civil War, all he has is a satchel with some old newspapers, and he wanders, as you say, from town to town reading the news for anyone who wants to hear it. And in a way, I think what he has is the healing power of storytelling. You know, by telling these stories, the local news, the news of the meningitis epidemics, the federal news, news from far, far away. He draws his audience into a relationship with him. And, you know, I think that telling stories is a healing activity. It draws the storyteller and the audience together.
A central part of the plot is that the man who we see hanging from a tree at the beginning of the movie, he was transporting a 10-year-old girl to her aunt and uncle. The girl had been kidnapped 6 years earlier, kidnapped and raised by Kiowa Indians after they killed her parents. And now her Kiowa family has been killed by white people, so she has been twice orphaned. And the black man who we see hanging from a tree, he was tasked with taking her to her only remaining white family, an aunt and uncle. So now with that man dead, she has nothing and no means of getting anywhere on her own. Hanks finds her, the captain finds her, and reluctantly takes on the responsibility of taking her, Johanna, to her aunt and uncle. It's a pretty long and dangerous journey, and a lot happens to them along the way. And it's hard for him to communicate with her because she only speaks Kiowa. And she identifies as a member of the Kiowa. Did you read a lot of history about that period?
I did. There's quite an extensive literature, actually, for these children who were kidnapped. It wasn't that unusual. And they were lost children, of course. But, you know, part of a wider landscape of lost people, I think. Pretty much everybody in the movie lives in the shadow of the Civil War, lives in the shadow of loss. And their journey, Kid and this little girl's journey, which begins wordlessly, is ultimately a journey towards finding a place to belong, I suppose, in this new landscape. And that, to me, felt inspiring and also was ultimately the reason why I made the film. You know, I wanted to make it because in lots of ways it's a film about the journey to hope, and that's something that's very important, I think, as the world looks ever more dark. We have to keep our minds fixed, I think, on where the hope is.
So were there newsreaders like the character Tom Hanks plays who actually were itinerant and read the news from town to town? For people who didn't have access to newspapers?
I think, yes. Of course, many people were illiterate in those days, weren't they? I mean, I think...
Oh, good point.
The newsreaders really have a gospel route. In my country, they would have been the Methodist preachers, the nonconformist preachers who weren't allowed to preach in the churches but went out into the town squares and brought the good news. And, of course, that... Later, after the American Revolution, that they were a feature of American life too. And of course, what starts as bringing the good news becomes bringing the news, you know, and they would leaven their gospel stories with local news. And so it became steadily the news.
Now, you've shot films based on real life events like the United Flight 93 on 9/11 that crashed because the passengers were taking over the plane from the hostage takers, and they prevented the plane from crashing into its intended target. You know, you did a film based on the Somali pirates who took over, you know, a cargo ship. And then you've also done these like big, like Jason Bourne movies, which are not exactly cinema verite. They're not exactly like documentary. They're action films. And then in the new movie, News of the World, the longest like action sequence in it is it's a shootout between Tom Hanks and three kind of twisted lost souls who want to basically buy the young girl from Tom Hanks and probably sell her into sexual servitude. But that scene, it's just like a really lo-fi shootout, you know, with Tom Hanks trying to hide behind rocks and use whatever he can as bullets to shoot at these three guys. Can you talk a little bit about like the different kinds of action sequences that you've shot after shooting real combat?
Well, you have to go back to my roots as, you know, in Britain, there wasn't then anyway, certainly a film industry. There was the television industry. That's where you went if you to work and cut your teeth and pay your dues and learn your craft. And what I was at a very young age was sent out into the world. You were sent out into the world with a crew, and you had to bring back a story from the world in action. And that meant going to places where, if it wasn't armed conflict, it was political conflict. And so that, I suppose, verite sense, that documentary eye, has never left me. That's my instinct. And I brought that to the Bourne movies too, by the way. You know, I think one of the reasons why young people particularly like the Bourne movies, because it was one of the first kind of movies that brought those kind of images into the mainstream, because that's what kids were used to. They were beginning to use their mobile phones and have all sorts of rough and raw and ready verite images, and that was their language. And Bourne, I think, just brought that language into the mainstream of Hollywood cinema. Now it's much more normal to see it.
You know, I'm wondering, having been in so many conflict zones and shot documentaries there, and now watching news footage from your home in England, news footage of an insurrection in the United States, what is it like for you to watch that, to know that, you know, it's not an emerging democracy, it's not a country where there has been just a super long history of authoritarian governments and dictatorships, it's the United States?
Well, I first came to the United States when I was 18 years old, and it's not my home country. I'm British, but it's a place I love, as I think many people who are not Americans do, you know. It's the great hope of our world, you know. So my feelings are of great shock and sadness, as I think most people's are. What did I think when I watched it? The last film I made was 22 July, about Anders Breivik, who was a right-wing terrorist in Norway who attacked the government and the young Labour group as well. You know, it was an attempt to decapitate the state. The reason I made that film is because Breivik, Anders Breivik, is a very important figure in the growth of the far right, both in America and in the UK and across Europe, because he's seen as a standard bearer. If you look at Charlottesville, all that trouble, a lot of the language that was being used by the white supremacists was Breivik's words from Breivik's manifesto. Same in some of the other right-wing attacks across Europe. You know, he's a profoundly important figure.
So you had to study, like, who he was and, you know, what he believed, what the manifesto was. What are some of the things that you started to believe about how somebody comes to believe lies, how somebody comes to believe that certain people are less than human, that certain people are worthy of being killed, and how, like, the truth, reality, is incapable of talking them out of it? Because that question is so relevant to right now.
I think Anders Breivik is a dreadful, dreadful, contemptible human being, guilty of the most heinous acts. That said, you must never misunderstand these people. It was not that he felt that the people that he killed were not human. He actually understood. He's a pretty intelligent man, Anders Breivik. What he was, and this is relevant today, was someone who believed that you needed to have a fight, that the battle needed to be waged with violence. And that is common now. That is that the genie is out of the bottle, if I can use that expression. Do you know what I mean? It's like that is out there in chat rooms, in the dark web, in the meetings, all across the West. And it's a big problem. And if you talk to anybody in law enforcement, FBI, you know, police, MI5 over here, you know, in Europe, the growth of the far right and their desire to give battle is a real fun. It's a reality. It's a reality, and it has to be dealt with. But it's going to be a generational struggle. This, just as it is against, you know, violent Islamist extremism, and it's part of the morbid symptoms of the failure of centrist politics.
I want to get back to Anders Breivik, because you did a dramatized version of him in your film 22 July. And he's the neo-Nazi, you know, terrorist who attacked people in Norway and had a manifesto that a lot of people on the far right have subsequently followed. Are you sometimes surprised that people who are neo-Nazis, white racists, that they're proud of it. They believe, this is how they think the world should be, and they don't mind people knowing that.
Well, the reason I made that film, 22 July, was because it was not about Breivik. I mean, he was a central, important character in it. The film was about Norway as an exemplar of how a democratic society faced with this menace of white supremacy, how they reacted to this immense threat. You know, I mean, it was a double attack. You know, he blew up the center of government, and then he went and killed the next generation of government leaders when he attacked the youth camp, you know. And it was deliberate. It was an attempt to decapitate the state. That was the whole idea behind it. And I chose a number of characters who had to respond to that, one of whom was the then Norwegian Prime Minister, now Secretary General of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg. Another was the lawyer who became the state-appointed lawyer for Breivik and had to ensure that he had a fair trial as best he could. And then obviously the principal character with the family who were caught up in it, the young man had been grievously wounded by him. And it was about their journeys to face him down. That was what the film was about. And what did that look like and feel like? So in the end, this young man did face him down in court. But the healing, as far as you could have it after an event like that, was very partial and muted, inevitably because of the damage he'd done. But it did leave me feeling intensely as a parent. I mean, how are we going to get out of this? What is the road out of this going to look like? What are the qualities that we have to look to get through this bitterness and division? That was what was going through my mind. And it was, as I say, 6 months later, I don't know, that I read News of the World. And when I read this beautiful novel about this lonely newsreader who embarks on this journey with this mysterious little girl, to take her to her surviving family. That is that road out of this. That's it. And then they're just ordinary characters. They're not famous people. They're not in the eye of some enormous storm. They're just, what it says is an attempt to understand kindness, seeing it through, facing down bigotry, standing up, telling the truth. He's a journalist. He stands up, doesn't he? He stands up in the end and says, no, I'm not going to read lies and substitute truth for lies. I'm going to speak my truth. And if necessary, he's prepared to fight for it. And that's heroic and beautiful and exciting. And of course, it's an adventure, as it should be in a movie, you know. And in the end, they find a way. And that's, you know, what I wanted. I wanted to make a film I could show my kids. So, you know, it's a family film. I've never made a family film. I wanted to do a Western. I wanted to do a family film, but I wanted it to have the world as I see it in it. But I wanted it to have a happy ending. That's actually, honestly, the truth of it. I wanted to make a film with a happy ending.
That's interesting. How did it feel to make a film with a happy ending?
Well, that was something that I had decided after I'd done 22 July. You know, I sat there, I want to make a film that has a happy ending. I want to, you know, not a schmaltzy sentimental film, because I wouldn't make that. It's not in my sensibility to do that. You know, these things turn around in your mind. I don't know how other filmmakers do it. I can never really sort of go, oh, I need to do a story about X, or I need to do a, you know, a science fiction movie. You know, to me, I sort of dwell on a question, a feeling, and one film, it's like a conversation you have with yourself, and you go, okay, well, I need to find a film with a happy ending. I need to find a film, but that feels earned from this world, you know. And well, what's that going to be? I don't know. God knows. And then, you know, serendipity. 6 months later, you read this and you go, that's it. And of course, it's a Western. I've never made a Western before. That's fantastic. You know, when you make films, you always have to have a eureka moment, I think, when you go, this is it. This is the film. I know what to do with this. This is great. All those threads that have been unconnected that I've been turning over in my mind for 6 months or whatever it is, suddenly this is the way I can tie them together and get a film. You know, the film will answer that question.
How did you like working with horses?
I loved it. I used to ride a little bit when I was young, but not now. But Tom was really good on a horse. He was fantastic. But it was thrilling. That's what I mean. You know, you go out in the desert and you see the horses and the wagons and the, you know, the way people dressed, and you're in the West. And it's mythic. And it's part of your boyish imagination, you know. And as I say, I loved it. I loved the experience of making it. It was physically demanding as a film. You know, there was a lot of heat and dust and freezing cold at night and climbing. I mean, that shootout, and we had to climb up that bluff. It was took 2 hours to get the crew up there, and you had to go up on ropes, and then there were rattlesnakes around the place, you know, and we had to have wranglers. You know, it was, but the adventure of it, I think, really brought people together. I think people loved that about it, you know.
You know, just a sidebar note, I don't think I've ever seen Tom Hanks in a Western before, except for Toy Story, where it's not a Western, but he is, you know, he is a toy wooden cowboy in it.
Well, he's the real deal in this, and I thought he sat well in that landscape. You know, he looked the part to me, and I love Tom when he's weathered and...
Yes, his face is dirty most of the time.
And has years and has experience behind his eyes. He's seen things, he's done things. It's a haunted quality to him. And it seems such an obvious thing to say that I think we almost take him for granted as a movie star because he is so consistently good in the things he does.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us, and thank you for making News of the World, which I enjoyed so much. Paul Greengrass, it's really been a pleasure.
Thanks a lot.
Paul Greengrass directed the new film News of the World, starring Tom Hanks. It's currently playing in theaters and is available on premium video on demand. We recorded our interview January 12th. Nadia Owusu is a Whiting Award-winning writer and urban planner. Her new memoir, Aftershocks, delves deep into the fault lines of her own racial identity and family story. Book critic Maureen Carrigan has this review.
When Nadia Owusu was 7 years old and living in Rome with her father, stepmother, younger sister, and baby half-brother, two events occurred on the same day that upended her world. The first was a disaster she didn't experience personally, but heard about on the radio. A catastrophic earthquake in Armenia, where her mother's family had lived before they sought refuge in America. The second was the sudden appearance of her mother, standing nervously at the front door, gripping a pair of red balloons in her hands. Owusu hadn't seen her mother for 3 years, but now there she was, along with her silent second husband. They'd been vacationing in Italy. Her mother whisked Nadia and her sister off for a day of fun before she vanished again. As happens, especially in the minds of children, those two events became soldered together in memory. Here's how Owusu puts it in her new memoir. When I was 7, my mother showed up with an earthquake and red balloons. I remember her shaking hands, and I remember the shaking earth. In me, private and seismic tremors cannot be separated. Owusu's lyrical and tough memoir is called Aftershocks, and though at first it may seem like an overly dramatic conceit for Owusu to tell the story of her life in terms of tremors, seismic shockwaves, and fault lines, those metaphors quickly come to seem apt, even restrained. Owusu's memoir is a classic search for identity story, one that's complicated by the fact that the ground beneath Owusu's feet is so unstable. Owusu's out-of-the-picture mother is white and Armenian-American. Her beloved father is black from Ghana. His work with the United Nations gave Nadia and her siblings a cosmopolitan upbringing. Italy, England, Ghana, Ethiopia, Uganda, but no fixed sense of home. Being biracial intensified Owusu's apartness. And then there are the abandonments that fractured Owusu's life. One I've mentioned already, her mother's unexplained departure when Nadia was 4. That's followed by the death of her father when she's 13, and almost simultaneously, the refusal of her mother to take in her and her sister. Instead, Owusu lived tempestuously with her stepmother until she left for college in New York, where, not surprisingly, in her late 20s, she experienced a breakdown. Owusu devotes a portion of this memoir to surveying the ruptured histories of the many countries she's connected to. But it's her striking personal story and charged language that makes Aftershocks compelling. Speaking of her father's death, Owusu comes to realize that grief is slow internal bleeding. Reflecting on the stories she'd heard about the opposition of her father's family in Ghana to his marriage to her white mother, Owusu passes on this critical folk adage, "Any river loses its identity when entering the sea." Feeling her breakdown approaching, Owusu describes stumbling out of the speeding purgatory of her subway train, running into her apartment, and spending 7 mostly sleepless days rocking in a ratty blue chair she picked up off the street. There, she forces herself to confront questions about my upended, dislocated body and mind, about the geography and geology of my experience, about who I was and how I'd ended up in the blue chair, about finding my way out of it. Aftershocks, Owusu's father had told her on the day of the Armenian earthquake, are the Earth's delayed reaction to stress. Owusu's breakdown is one kind of aftershock. This well-wrought, often powerful memoir is another.
Maureen Carrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Aftershocks by Nadia Owusu. The restrictions caused by the pandemic have changed the amount of time many of us spend moving, walking, standing. If you're used to going to work but have spent the better part of the year at home and you can't go to the gym because it's closed, or you just don't feel safe doing it, or you don't even have time to take a walk because you're working and have children at home all day because their schools are closed, well, how's that affecting your body and your general health and your mental outlook? My guest, Daniel Lieberman, writes about the importance of exercise and the myths surrounding it in his new book, Exercised, Why Something We Never Evolved to Do is Healthy and Rewarding. Some of the questions he addresses include, is sitting the new smoking? Is it bad to slouch? Do you really need 8 hours of sleep? Is walking effective for losing weight? Does running ruin your knees? He writes from his perspective as a paleoanthropologist. He's a professor in the Department of Human Evolutionary Biology at Harvard. In his lab at Harvard, he and his students conduct experiments to study the anatomy, biomechanics, and physiology that underlie various exercises and activities. His research has led him to remote villages in Africa and Latin America that have not been industrialized. He studied how much time indigenous people there sit, sleep, walk, forage, dance, and run. He's compared their activities, their bodies, their health and longevity to that of Americans. Daniel Lieberman, welcome back to Fresh Air. Thank you for joining us. So during COVID, I feel like everybody's lives has changed in one way or another. So I'm going to mention a couple of things about my life. I typically, for many years, have worked at the radio station. During COVID, I've been working from home. Simple things that are causing me to take fewer steps in my working life. The bathroom was further away in the office than it is in my small home. I'd walk every day a few blocks to get lunch and then walk a few blocks back to get it home. I'm not doing that now. I'm just making something really quickly for myself. However, I'm still taking walks and I'm spending more time making meals because I can't eat out. And I'm spending more time, therefore, washing dishes since I eat three meals at home now instead of none or two since I'm not in the office or eating out. So my first question is, can I count standing and cooking and washing dishes and cleaning as exercise?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, I should mention that my step count has also gone down by about 50% for all the same reasons. Well, I think it's important to make a distinction between physical activity, which is just moving, right, including making, you know, breakfast and lunch and going to the bathroom and all those sorts of things, and exercise, which is physical activity that's sort of discretionary and voluntary for the sake of health and fitness. And so what the pandemic has done for a lot of, almost all of us, is to decrease our physical activity, right? I'm not going to work either. I'm working from home. I'm, not making as many trips to, you know, to do errands. All those kinds of things are really kind of cutting down on how much I'm sort of walking about. But I'm trying to compensate with exercise, but that's also been challenging. And so the end result is that my overall physical activity levels have definitely decreased, regardless of my attempts to compensate with exercise. So not all physical activity is exercise. Exercise is a special kind of physical activity.
Okay, so you're saying that I can't count washing dishes and washing the floors and standing up preparing food instead of sitting eating at a restaurant, that I can't count that as exercise, but I can count that as some form of physical activity, right?
Yeah.
For those of us in that position where we're doing more housework and we're doing more cooking and washing dishes, that's still physically better than just sitting. And,
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, no, it's what matters is physical activity. It's just that we've created a world in which we don't have to do much work anymore, right? We don't have to be very physically active. And so today, people do something very strange, which is they go on a treadmill, or they go for a 5-mile run in the morning for the sake of just the 5-mile run, or they lift weights whose sole purpose is to be lifted. That's exercise, and that's a very modern behavior. People never did that before, because until recently, people had to be much more physically active every day in order to get food, or sometimes to avoid being somebody else's food.
There's a great story you tell in your book. You just mentioned treadmills, and this story has to do with the treadmill. Like I said, you go done a lot of studying in remote villages where people are still basically foraging and hunting for food, and you're comparing their physical activity with ours and their bodies with ours. So in a remote village in Kenya, you managed to transport there a treadmill. What was your point in bringing a treadmill to this village?
Well, so yeah, we've been working in a community up at the top of the Western Rift Valley in Kenya for almost 12 years now, and the community has no paved roads, there's no electricity, there's no running water, and people do everything by hand, everything. And one of the things that people do is they carry everything. They carry, especially women. Women carry a lot of firewood. Women carry huge sort of jerry cans of water, often long distances up hills. And we are interested in how people carry, because we have some evidence that women can carry, you know, huge weights, like 20% of their body mass on their heads with no extra cost. And we were curious how they did that. So we have some fancy machines that measure oxygen, so we could measure how much energy they're spending. And we thought the best way to do this would be on a treadmill. So we bought a treadmill and schlepped it up these horrible roads to get it to this area, and we found the closest place where we could plug it in, and then we drove we got our, you know, with a Jeep, we got our participants to the treadmill, and it was a total disaster. Because if you've never been on a, if you're a 40, 50-year-old person and you've never been on a treadmill your entire life, it's a very strange and awkward experience. And the women, they got a kick out of it. They sort of enjoyed the treadmill, but they weren't walking normally the way they normally walk, because it's such a strange, bizarre, flummoxing contraption. And so we actually had to, after all that time and energy and effort to get the treadmill up there, we had to abandon using the treadmill. Instead, did the experiment outside over ground.
One of the themes of your book is that we never evolved to exercise, but nowadays we need to exercise. And you're right, you've said insufficient regular exercise is abnormal and pathological. So let's start with, how can you say that we didn't evolve to exercise? What do you mean by that?
Well, exercise is discretionary, planned, voluntary physical activity for the sake of health and fitness, right? It's like what I did this morning. I went for a 5-mile run, right? Solely for the sake of the fact that it's good for my health, and both mental as well as physical. But in the past, nobody did that. In the past, people every day were physically active. They would go out and walk, or sometimes run and dig things and carry things and do all kinds of other activities that were necessary to get food. But they struggled to get enough energy, and they were already pretty physically active. And so spending extra energy to do something that had no benefit is actually a problem, right? It's a cost. It takes energy away from other functions that are important, like taking care of your body or reproducing. So until recently, when energy was limited and people were physically active, doing physical activity that wasn't necessarily rewarding just didn't happen. When I go to these villages, I'm the only person who gets up in the morning and goes for a run, and often they laugh at me. They think I'm just absolutely bizarre. They think it's pretty funny. You know, why would anybody do something like that?
So another reason why you say we haven't evolved to exercise is that we evolved to conserve calories, because we evolved to do the hunting and gathering and taking care of children and all that, and then to conserve calories after that because there might not be enough food. And so expand on that if you would.
Yeah, so humans are incredibly energetically expensive creature. We are very energetically intense. We spend a lot of energy on our bodies, but we also struggle to get all that energy because we have an energetically intensive reproductive strategy. We have an energetically intensive physical activity strategy. You know, we spend a lot of energy. Here's an interesting fact. The average sedentary American is still more active than a typical wild chimpanzee. You know, chimpanzees will walk a few miles a day, 2 to 3 miles a day, but even a sedentary American does about that or a little bit more. Because chimpanzees spend most of their time just eating. They just put food in their mouth and mostly rest. But we not only spend a lot of energy just going around doing things, but also we have a very energetically intensive reproductive strategy. We have babies at twice the rate as our cousins, the chimpanzees. We spend a lot longer growing up, so we have to invest more energy in growing our bodies, and the list goes on. So until recently, people struggled to get enough food, but they have a very energetically intensive strategy. And so when that occurs, you have trade-offs, right? You can't, you know, every time you spend energy on one thing, you can't spend it on something else. And so energy spent on unnecessary physical activity was detrimental. So we evolved to spend energy when it was necessary or rewarding. And otherwise, it makes sense to take it easy. So, you know, when people aren't working in, you know, non-Western, non-industrial environments, they tend to rest and take it easy and not spend unnecessary calories, unless there's some benefit, like dancing, for example, which is obviously very beneficial for social reasons and mental health reasons and for play. Play is obviously very important. But other than that, they take it easy.
We also didn't evolve to sit in chairs all day. So a question you ask in your book, and I want to ask you your thoughts about this, is, are our chairs killing us? Is it true that sitting is the new smoking, that sitting for long periods is as damaging as smoking is?
Well, I decided to start the book with a discussion about physical inactivity, because if you want to understand physical activity, we also have to understand inactivity, which is what we actually spend most of the time doing. Whether you're a modern, you know, desk chair bound professor like me, or a hunter gatherer or a subsistence farmer. And recently we've sort of demonize sitting, right? Sitting is the new smoking, and you can regularly pick up the newspaper or click on websites which tell you that, you know, if every hour you sit, 2 hours of your life walk away, you know, and there's all kinds of scary statistics about sitting. So I was curious about that. And because one of my experiences are that when I walk into a village in a remote part of the world where people don't have chairs or like a hunter-gatherer camp, people are always sitting. And it turns out, some friends and colleagues of mine actually put some accelerometers on some hunter-gatherers and found that they sit on average about 10 hours a day, which is pretty much the same amount of time Americans like me spend sitting. So it turns out that I think we kind of demonize sitting a little falsely. It's not unnatural or strange or weird or to sit all the time or sit a lot, but it is problematic if, of course, that's all you do. And as I started to explore the literature more, I was fascinated because most of the data that associates sitting a lot with poor health outcomes turns out to be a leisure time sitting. So if you look at how much time people spend sitting at work, it's not really that associated with heart disease or cancers or diabetes. But if you look at how much people sit when they're not at work, well, then the numbers get a little bit scary.
So some people say that if you sit too long, too frequently, that it can harm your immune system. It could trigger your immune system and create inflammation. Do you think that's true? And if so, what is the connection between sitting and inflammation?
Well, it turns out that that is true, that sitting too much does lead to chronic inflammation. But it turns out that there are two factors. The first is that it's really leisure time sitting, which is mostly associated with that. And that's because if you sit at work and then you go home and you sit all the time as well, that means you're probably not getting any physical activity, which means you're probably gaining weight, which gaining weight is associated with higher levels of inflammation. But the other thing that's really fascinating is that just getting up every once in a while, every 10 minutes or so, just to, you know, go to the bathroom or pet your dog or make yourself a cup of tea, even though you're not spending a lot of energy, you're turning on your muscles. And your muscles, of course, are the largest organ in your body. And just turning them on turns down inflammation. It uses up fats in your bloodstream and sugars in your bloodstream, and it produces molecules that turn down inflammation. So the evidence is that interrupted sitting is really the best way to sit. So if, you know, in hunter-gatherer camps, you know, people getting up every few minutes, you know, to take care of the fire or take care of a kid or something like that. And that kind of interrupted sitting, as well as sitting in which you're not sitting in a chair that's kind of nestling your body and preventing you from using any muscles, all that kind of keeps your muscles going and turns out to be a much healthier way to sit.
Let's move on to running. And you asked the question, is it true that running is bad for your knees? What does the research have to say?
Yeah, there's this kind of general idea out there that running is like, you know, driving your car too much. It's like it's wear and tear, right? And that running is highly stressful and just wears away your cartilage, just like driving your car for a long period of time, you know, wears out your springs, for example. And that turns out not to be true. study after study has shown that in terms of wear, which we merely mean arthritis, right, degeneration of the cartilage in your joints, that people who run more are not more likely to get arthritis in their knees. In fact, they're actually slightly less likely to get arthritis because using your cartilage, using your joints, using your muscles, strength, all the good benefits from physical activity actually turn out to be slightly protective. That said, it's also true that the most common site of injury for runners is their knees, but a lot of those injuries I think are preventable by learning to run properly. And I think, you know, we don't treat running as a skill in our culture. We just, you know, give people shoes and tell them to head out the door. And some people run really well, and some people don't run that well, or they're not really well. You know, their bodies aren't really well adapted to running, and then they get into trouble. But in terms of wear and tear, I think we can dispel that myth completely.
Let's talk about muscle atrophy. Because that's part of the problem. Like if you don't exercise, you literally lose muscle strength. The muscles stop working. What happens when muscles atrophy, and why do they atrophy?
Yeah, I think one of the most important points about physical activity is that as we age, it becomes not less but more important to be physically active. And muscle atrophy is the perfect example. So, you know, we have this sort of notion that as you get older, you retire, you go to Florida, you kick your feet up on the beach or, you know, whatever. But But what happens is that when you do that, and we have plenty of evidence that older individuals in America are less physically active and they do less, fewer activities that involve strength. And one of the really sort of serious negative consequences of that is that our muscles dwindle, they atrophy. There's a technical term for that, which I think is illuminating. It's called sarcopenia. Sarco means flesh in Greek, and penia means loss, so it's flesh loss. But basically, it's frailty. And as we get older and become more frail, a vicious circle sets in because we, you know, we walk more slowly, it's harder to get out of a chair, and that makes us even less likely to be physically active, which keeps that cycle going. So that's the bad news. But the good news is that it doesn't take a huge amount of physical activity to kind of reverse that, turn it around. I mean, think about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who, you know, she was celebrated for her vim and vigor, a lot of that came from the fact that she kept working out as she got older. She went to the gym several times a week, and, you know, she didn't crazy pump iron stuff. She didn't, you know, wasn't trying to be like Arnold Schwarzenegger, but she did, you know, a few rounds of weight training every week, and that helped keep her, you know, marvelously active and vigorous up until her late 80s. And the mechanisms that get turned on when we do a little bit of strength training don't diminish with age. So if you're in your 80s or your 90s and you do a little strength training, you'll still get enormous benefits.
Daniel Lieberman, a pleasure to talk with you again. Thank you so much, and stay healthy, stay well.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it, too.
Daniel Lieberman is a Harvard professor and the author of the new book, Exercised.